This program is a production of Restoring the Core, an initiative designed to assist those wishing to go deeper into classic Christianity, with resources available in a connected age, online at restoringthecore.com. This is Finding Hidden Treasure, episode number 67. Today's episode is part 4 of our exploration of Christian treasures in London. Welcome to Finding Hidden Treasure, an ongoing discussion of resources available for those looking to go deeper into classic Christianity. In the last 3 episodes, I've been speaking of my wife's and my trip to London to celebrate our 25th wedding anniversary, and the visits that we made to a number of Christian historic sites in that city. In this episode, I'll be discussing a Christian historic site that is not in London, but relatively close by, only 90 minutes away by rail train. That site is Canterbury Cathedral. We left for Canterbury early in the afternoon on the Saturday of our visit. Earlier that morning, I had the opportunity to tour the reconstruction of the Shakespearean-era Globe Theatre. During our tour, I was recalling an article which I read in the summer of 2009. It was entitled Shakespeare in the Geneva Bible by Wheaton College Professor of English Leland Ryken. The essence of Dr. Ryken's article was that the Geneva Bible, the foremost English translation of the scriptures for 50 years before the first printing of the King James Version, had a tremendous influence on William Shakespeare, an influence which can be seen throughout his plays. In the article, Dr. Ryken made the following comment. Numerically, the book with the most references is the Book of Psalms, and usually Shakespeare refers to this book as it appears in the Anglican Book of Prayer, that is, the Book of Common Prayer. Other biblical books that are high in the number of references are Genesis, Matthew, and Job. The Bible story that appears most often, more than 25 times, is the story of Cain and Abel. There are so many references to the opening chapters of Genesis in Shakespeare's plays that scholars make comments to the effect that Shakespeare must have had these chapters nearly memorized. Shakespeare's allusions are sometimes generalized, as for example to characters in the Bible, but often the parallels are linguistic and specific, requiring a specialist's knowledge. While no one attending Shakespeare's plays at the Globe would have mistaken his plays for a sermon or an extended biblical teaching, Dr. Ryken does point out that the legacy of the translation known as the Geneva Bible had such a strong influence on the culture of its time that its footprint, so to speak, can be seen in many references and allusions which are embedded in William Shakespeare's plays. I will have a link to Dr. Ryken's article on the Restoring the Core webpage for this episode. Shortly after I got back to our hotel, my wife and I left to go to Canterbury. Christianity in Britain dates back to the year 597 to the missionary work of a man sent by Pope Gregory, whose name was Augustine. This is not the same Augustine who is perhaps one of the best-known saints and theologians of the Christian Church. The original Augustine lived in North Africa in the early 400s AD. This later Augustine lived about 200 years later. This later Augustine set up a mission at this site in Canterbury, close to the English Channel. A church building was set up on the site of what is now Canterbury Cathedral as early as the year 602. This site was an important spiritual center for Christianity in England for centuries after this. It became a major site for pilgrimage after the death of Thomas Becket, the Archbishop of Canterbury. In their younger years, Thomas was good friends with a man named Henry, who would become King Henry II. Upon the death of the then sitting Archbishop of Canterbury in 1161, King Henry II promoted his friend Thomas to the office of Archbishop of Canterbury. Henry expected that this would result in Thomas allowing the king to exercise control not only over the state, but the church as well. Thomas, who took his new office very seriously, insisted that the church was above the law of the state. A clash of state and church power ensued for a number of years. In December of 1170, King Henry, being very frustrated by actions taken by Thomas to remove two bishops from power, uttered the words, "Will no one rid me of this meddlesome priest?" 4 knights heard Henry's words and took them as a call to action against Thomas. The knights traveled to Canterbury, arriving on the afternoon of December 29th, 1170. After trying to get Thomas, unsuccessfully, to restore the bishops to power, the 4 knights attacked Thomas, splitting his skull and scattering his brains on the floor of the cathedral. Soon, many began to regard Thomas as a saint and began special pilgrimages to Canterbury to visit the site of his tomb. The ongoing pilgrimages to Canterbury inspired the author Geoffrey Chaucer to write one of the earliest foundational works of English literature, called The Canterbury Tales. It is a fictional account of pilgrims who leave the Tabard Inn in Southwark, an area of what is today central London, to go on pilgrimage to Canterbury, telling tales as they travel to make the time pass more quickly. A quick side note is that in April of 2012, a group of 21st century real-life pilgrims, under the direction of Henry Elliott, did in real life what Chaucer fictionally wrote about, namely, doing a real-life enactment of Canterbury Tales. Leaving from the Tabard Inn, they would travel on pilgrimage to Canterbury, telling Chaucer's tales along the way. I'll be providing a link to the account of that pilgrimage on the Restoring the Core webpage for this episode. Exactly 2.5 years after those 21st century pilgrims left Southwark to go to Canterbury, my wife and I went on pilgrimage to Canterbury as well. We didn't leave from the Tabard Inn, which happened to be a little under a mile from where we were staying. We did leave on rail train, going from Waterloo Station for the about 60-mile or about 100-kilometer journey to Canterbury. Since we had spent the last several days in London, we found it interesting as we traveled out to see the change in scenery, from the buildings of central London to the residential areas on the outskirts of the city, and then traveling through the green rolling hills of the English countryside. It took less than 90 minutes for us to make the trip to the Canterbury West train station, from which we would walk to actually go to the cathedral. The town seemed to me to be quite lively, with buildings whose age seemed to vary quite a bit. Many of them old, many of them new. My first sight of the cathedral was breathtaking. Perhaps it was because there were no other large buildings nearby. However, the cathedral seemed to me to be remarkably big, even after we had seen Westminster Abbey only 2 days earlier. We entered through a very impressive structure called the Christ Church Gate, built just under 500 years ago, to get to the precincts of the cathedral. We were told that pilgrims to Canterbury have come through this gate for centuries. Once again, my sense of history was out of scale compared to anything I was used to back in the Detroit area. This gate was built within only a few years of the start of the Protestant Reformation. Standing inside the precincts, looking up at the cathedral, was simply stunning. This building in its size looked to be the size of a mountain, but one that was constructed by human hands. As I discovered on our tour, the cathedral was constructed in stages, with the earliest existing areas dating back to around the year 1070, while the most recent sections were built around the year 1500. As we entered the building, I was amazed by what seemed to me a larger interior than Westminster Abbey has. The lengths are almost identical, but the configuration of the inside of Canterbury seemed to be more open. Like Westminster, there were memorials throughout the cathedral. However, they seemed to be less in number. When we first entered the cathedral, we sat on some chairs that were present and spent a few minutes in prayer. We were blessed to be there on a sunny day as strong sunlight shone through the very large windows on the south side of the cathedral. As I sat there, I reflected on how many people, over many centuries, watched the light of the sun going through those very same windows. My wife stayed seated while I went to explore some other areas of the cathedral. We caught back up with each other a few minutes later. I noticed that she had been crying. I asked if anything was wrong. She indicated that nothing was wrong. Rather, she was remembering when she first visited the cathedral in the early 1980s. She was not a believer in Christ at that time. Canterbury Cathedral was a required part of the tour for her and some of her co-workers at the travel agency at which she worked at the time. Apparently, the first stirrings of what would be her conversion a few years later happened during that visit in the 1980s. For her, during our trip, it was in a sense coming full circle as she reflected on the faith journey she has taken since she was at Canterbury the last time. She believes that God used the stunning, transcendent beauty of this cathedral to get her attention concerning Him. Among the many memorials and tombs which exist in Canterbury Cathedral, one name stood out to me from my reading over the years. While we were in the area of the cathedral, known as the Bluffs Regimental Chapel, we were at one point standing in front of the area of the burial site of Stephen Langton, an Archbishop of Canterbury, who died in the year 1228. I learned after our visit that he was instrumental in the creation of the Magna Carta in 1215. Where I recognize this name, though, had to do with the history of Bible translation. If, when you hear a preacher or a teacher say something such as, "Please turn to the Gospel of John, chapter 1, you have Stephen Langton to thank for that. Not for the Gospel of John, of course, but for the chapter 1 part. Langton is credited with developing the chapter divisions which we use in our Bibles to this very day. There are so many areas of the cathedral which I could speak about. However, let me confine myself to just a few. While we were there, evening prayer, or evensong, was going to be conducted during the 3 o'clock hour. Those visiting in the cathedral at that time were invited to participate. Not only were my wife and I able to be present and able to participate in the service, we were able to sit in the choir during the service. What a tremendous honor to sit in a choir area set aside for such devotional practice as far back as the late 1100s. Once more, I let my imagination loose and began to think of all those individuals over the many centuries who sat in these very same spots in which we were sitting, who sang praises to God over so many centuries. I can only guess how many times the walls of the cathedral heard the words of Psalm 93 and 94 being sung, just as we are hearing them on that day. Remember that a few minutes ago, I spoke of the medieval pilgrimages that were made to Canterbury and how they centered around Thomas Becket, who was murdered in the cathedral. The site of Thomas's killing is well marked off and memorialized in Canterbury Cathedral. It is a stark reminder that Christians must be willing to give their lives for Christ, and that sometimes very brutal persecution does not come so much from outside the faith, but from those who claim the name of Christ as their own. One further reminder of the importance of the memory of Thomas Becket is found even today on the east end of the cathedral. 50 years after the murder of Thomas Becket, a shrine with his remains was built in Trinity Chapel. The shrine stood there as the focal point of pilgrimage for many who came to Canterbury. The shrine stood from the year 1220 until the year 1538, when King Henry VIII, who had assumed control of the Church of England, ordered the shrine destroyed and Becket's bones to be burned and scattered to the winds. However, there continues to this day a silent reminder of what once stood there. On the floor of Trinity Chapel, on the very spot of Becket's shrine, stands one lit candle, a silent yet powerful reminder of the man who became a martyr in his own church almost 850 years ago. Many Christians will go on pilgrimage to a certain location to hopefully see the power of God work in that place. Whether God is kind enough to do that for them is up to him, as he is himself the sovereign Lord. For some, like my wife, God began to act even when the pilgrim did not seek his help. For myself, the pilgrimage to Canterbury was a tangible reminder that God has worked in real history and in real places. Real people, not fictional characters such as the one in Chaucer's Canterbury Tales, have come to this cathedral over a staggeringly long period of time. That place, less than 10 miles from the English Channel, is a reminder that God's love, concern, and power were not limited to the past and only to one location. As the psalmist says in Psalm 44, verse 1, "O God, we have heard with our ears, our fathers have told us, what deeds you performed in their days, in the days of old." The very ongoing history and existence of Canterbury Cathedral teaches us that as God acted in the past, he can and does act for his people today in the scattered places in which they live and the times to which he has called them. Thank you for listening to this program. We can be contacted at mail@restoringthecore.com. We're on Facebook at www.facebook.com/restoringthecore. You can also follow us on Twitter at @RestoreTheCore. My original blog is still active and can be found at schoolofthesolitaryplace.blogspot.com. Thank you for listening. We hope you will join us next time for Finding Hidden Treasure.